I think American schools teach too little about evolution. A lot of the information regarding evolution is taught uncritically.
I don't think this is good science education for the students in that district, and apparently neither did his colleagues nor his superintendent.
Our job is to teach the adopted curriculum, and that's what we follow.
The controversy is about whether a science teacher can actually give students evidence that's critical in Darwin's theory of evolution.
We want them to learn a religiously inspired critique of science based on faulty interpretations and non-existent facts.
The separation of church and state could crumble under mounting pressure from those
who could not verbally share any of this information with my students.
The role of a high school teacher is not to be on the cutting edge of research.
I have never seen such intolerance in a political issue.
The icons of evolution, these are examples of textbook evidences that actually distort the scientific evidence.
The controversy in modern times is not between science and religion, it's between two different interpretations of the same scientific evidence.
Scientists are supposed to question things. Scientists are supposed to be open to new evidence.
And I'm a scientist. I don't know any evidence against evolution.
That's okay for a PBS special, but that's not the real world. That's not what's taking place.
They won't allow a debate to go on. They try to stop it. The reason they try to stop it is they don't think they can win it.
Burlington, Washington, a quiet, peaceful community about an hour north of Seattle. An unlikely setting for a battleground, but that's exactly what it has become. On a recent night, hundreds of parents, teachers, and students gathered at the local high school because of biology teacher Roger DeHart.
Already, I'm being chastised or criticized that somehow my students can't understand.
For 15 years, DeHart has been a popular teacher at Burlington High School. Now, he's under fire for his teaching of evolution.
Based on Darwinian evolution, or based on evolution, we would say that which ones would be the fittest?
I think it's very important for students to understand evolution. I think it's important that I teach students evolution and that they understand it so that they'll be successful in universities if they choose to go on. Well, I love biology. The thing that intrigues me was just the different habitats and ecosystems and things like that. I was intrigued by that. I love being out there, and so I had a real love for biology. The more I learn about the complexity of life, genetics and the human genome and the idea of this information in the cell. I think it's fascinating.
What is the mechanism?
But DeHart's passion for biology is tempered by frustration. Frustration that students aren't learning enough about evolution. According to DeHart, teachers and textbooks are not presenting an accurate representation of evolutionary theory.
Either some of the current leading research is being left out, so it's dated, or else it's just plain misrepresented.
Because of his desire for students to learn accurate science, DeHart decided to supplement the standard unit on evolution with additional materials. Then someone complained. A citizens group was organized. Groups from outside the community began to lobby the school district, and the dispute became an issue in school board elections. The controversy polarized Burlington.
Most widely discussed trial of the 20s, the Darwin case, July 24th, 1925.
Of course, this is not the first time evolution has divided a community. Back in the 1920s, Dayton, Tennessee prosecuted high school teacher John Scopes for teaching evolution to students in violation of state law. Remembered today as a classic battle pitting religious fundamentalists against defenders of science and academic freedom. The Scopes trial continues to affect how we view the controversy over evolution in the schools.
According to defense attorneys, was the right to teach what science had found factual.
But there is one important and unexpected difference between John Scopes and Roger DeHart. Scopes was a proponent of evolution. DeHart is not. And those who are trying to censor him from teaching too much about evolution are not religious fundamentalists. They are supporters of Darwin's theory.
I think American schools teach too little about evolution. I think that a lot of the information regarding evolution is taught uncritically.
Does natural selection provide you with more information?
They're not asking students to really examine the evidence given and to ask whether or not that's a plausible explanation. It's more or less regurgitate the facts, regurgitate what we've told you, and don't question, because if you question, that means that you must have a religious belief, and that must motivate your objections to evolution rather than the science.
Caught in the middle of that clash and the shouting match,
DeHart's situation caught the awareness of the national press, setting off a frenzy of media attention.
The ACLU disagreed and filed a complaint with the school.
The separation of church and state could crumble under mounting pressure from those who want creationism taught as science.
In the local newspaper, opponents of DeHart took out a full-page ad and filled the pages with angry letters to the editor.
Fanatics like DeHart and his cohorts will never be
satisfied. The issue is whether students receive the education they're legally entitled to, free of contamination by the religious agenda of DeHart.
Mr. DeHart stands exposed as the fox in the hen house, from which he should be ejected.
When parents discovered that their children, in their view, were not being taught science, but rather were being taught basically incorrect facts and wrong science on the basis of what they thought was Mr. DeHart's religious motivation, they had every reason to petition their Board of Education for the redress of that grievance.
Contrary to state law, Darwin's theory of evolution.
When the Scopes trial took place in 1925, you had a large part of the country where school boards would not allow Darwinian evolution to be taught. I think that's hardly true anywhere, and certainly nobody wants that to be true today. What you have is the Scopes trial turned on its head now, because you've got people who say in school boards, you can't teach any criticism of Darwin.
Often all we hear about are the creationists who are trying to stop teachers from teaching evolution. But that really is an outdated stereotype. If it ever was accurate, it certainly isn't any longer. The sort of teachers now not allowed to teach science are teachers like Roger DeHart, who are being told that they can't criticize Darwin in the classroom.
The Roger DeHart controversy is just typical of many in the country. What he's trying to do is show that there are serious, growing concerns among scientists about Darwinian evolution.
The controversy in modern times is not between science and religion, it's between two different interpretations of the same scientific evidence. It's not science versus religion, it's science versus science.
There's no controversy among scientists over whether evolution took place. I don't know anybody who argues against whether evolution took place, except for those who have religious reasons for it.
Anytime anyone criticizes Darwin's theory of evolution, evolutionists immediately cry, it's about religion.
Well, the claim that all skeptics about Darwinian orthodoxy or Christian fundamentalists stands refuted by me. It's obviously not true. I'm neither Christian nor a fundamentalist. But lots and lots of people are skeptical in the scientific community.
I became skeptical of Darwinian evolution early on, outside of any religious influence, just because of the complexity that I was learning about in the cell, and we use the word elegant in genetics. So I removed myself. In part, evolution was a powerful explanatory mechanism, but it seemed insufficient.
School officials informed DeHart that any supplemental materials he wanted to assign, even articles from mainstream science publications, now had to be submitted for approval.
I know of no other teacher who actually submitted articles to the principal for review up until my controversy.
According to DeHart, His principal rejected all his requests, and he was forbidden from using any outside materials that might be critical of evolution.
They went from not allowing me to introduce any supplemental materials, then to telling me that I could not verbally share any of this information with my students.
The fact of the matter is, every other teacher in Burlington's school district was allowed to assign supplementary materials whenever they want. But when Roger DeHart decided to assign a few articles from mainstream science journals, they censored him.
One article Roger DeHart wanted to show students was from the American Biology Teacher, the leading peer-reviewed journal for secondary school biology teachers. It was written by Jonathan Wells, a biologist with a Ph.D. in molecular and cell biology from the University of California at Berkeley. Wells is one of a growing number of scientists raising objections to Darwin's theory. In his article, Wells points out how many textbooks continue to use fraudulent drawings of embryos made by 19th century German Darwinist Ernst Haeckel.
Ernst Haeckel was a German biologist and artist, a contemporary of Darwin's, who, among other things, made some famous drawings of vertebrate embryos, fish, humans, salamanders, chicks, turtles, and so on. And in those drawings, Haeckel tried to show that all these different vertebrates look very much the same as early embryos. Their early similarities showed that they came from a common ancestor, and differences arose only later. The problem is that he faked his drawings. The early vertebrate embryos don't really look that similar at all.
The problem with Haeckel's drawings wasn't just that they were inaccurate. They were actually false in many cases. But the real damage was done when these drawings entered into biology textbooks decades ago, and they've never really been taken out. If you open a high school biology text now, or even a college biology text, you'll find these drawings, although they may not refer to them as Haeckel's drawings, and in fact, they trace their ancestry directly to Haeckel.
See the pictures of the embryos.
And it's really damaged our understanding of development and our understanding of biology in general.
It's clear that Haeckel may have fudged his drawings somewhat to look more like his ideal than they actually are. Now, does that actually take away from what we know about the relationship of embryology to evolution? Not a bit. The whole Haeckel's embryo story has been greatly blown out of significance. It is a minor footnote in the history of science, and actually it's been known for 10 or 15 years that Haeckel's embryos are not to be relied upon. The reason why the diagrams are reproduced is because they're easily available. There's no copyright on them. It's an easy way to illustrate a point. And I would argue that the basic point that's being illustrated by those drawings is still accurate.
But if you go back earlier in development, the different classes of vertebrates look even more different.
According to Wells, Haeckel, in many modern textbooks, mislead students not just because of fake drawings, but because they leave out the earliest stages of embryonic development. What students are shown as the first stage of embryonic development is actually the mid-stage.
And very few textbooks show those earliest stages, and yet that's the whole point. It's the earliest stages that are supposed to be the most similar, and they're not. Some textbooks actually use photographs of embryos, but they pick only that stage and those classes that happen to look most similar. And they omit the earlier stages, and they omit those classes that don't look similar. So that, to me, is picking the evidence very carefully to support the theory, and that's not good science.
Wells is a critic of Darwin's theory, but even staunch evolutionists like Harvard's Stephen Jay Gould have criticized the use of diagrams based on Haeckel in textbooks.
Stephen Jay Gould wrote an article for Natural History saying that we need to let go of this, of these drawings, that basically that they're not needed.
But when DeHart requested permission to let students read Gould's article, that request was turned down too.
Why does Mr. DeHart feel so strongly to have these articles read? Well, it's because he wants to call into question the whole issue of whether evolution happened. I don't think this is good science education for the students in that district, and apparently neither did his colleagues nor his superintendent.
We have a science curriculum. We have a mainstream science theory called evolution. Our job is to teach the adopted curriculum, and that's what we follow.
But just how important are Haeckel's embryos? And does a single textbook mistake even matter?
If Haeckel's embryo drawings were the only problem with biology textbooks, I would agree that this is an isolated error. The problem is that it's not the only problem.
In fact, says Wells, today's textbooks are filled with outdated examples for evolution, which many evolutionary biologists no longer consider good science. In a recent book, he calls these the icons of evolution.
The icons of evolution, these are examples of textbook evidences that have taken on a life of their own. They go far beyond the truth, far beyond the facts, and have become symbols, in effect, of Darwin's theory. Symbols that actually distort the scientific evidence. In many cases, they're called icons by Darwinian biologists themselves.
The second icon of evolution, according to biologist Jonathan Wells, are finches found on the Galapagos Islands off of South America, islands Darwin visited in 1835 on the voyage of HMS Beagle.
Another icon of evolution are some species of birds on the Galapagos Islands that are very similar except for the size and shape of their beaks. And it's thought, and it's quite possible, that they evolved from a common ancestor because of having to eat different foods on the different islands.
In 1994, journalist Jonathan Weiner published The Beak of the Finch, a book about research into the Galapagos finches. It won the Pulitzer Prize. Weiner argued that the finches represent the best and most detailed demonstration to date of the power of Darwin's process. Similar claims are made in many biology textbooks.
The Galapagos finches are a spectacular example of evolution. When the food quality, in other words, the kind of food that was available, changed as a result of a drought or a particularly rainy year or something like that, over the course of just a couple of years, they could see dramatic changes in the beak sizes in various populations. Natural selection can drive changes of a structure, like the beak, in one direction in response to selective pressure, not just fast enough to account for what would be required for Darwin's theories, but actually 50 to 100 times faster than that.
A severe drought could cause many of the finches to die and leave only those with larger beaks. So in the following generation, the average beak size was increased. And some textbooks extrapolate this over 200 years or so and say that a few of these events strung together could transform these finches into a new species by making their beaks larger.
Look, the stuff about finch beaks is certainly interesting. Let's not confuse ourselves about that. The question is, can it be extrapolated, or does it represent cyclic variation?
What the books fail to mention is that as soon as the rains came back, the average beak size returned to normal. There was no net evolution. What we're really seeing is just one species oscillating back and forth with no real evolutionary change. So the evidence is exaggerated to make it appear to support Darwin's theory in a way that it really doesn't.
The contrary may be true. We may be seeing the development of entirely new species. The Galapagos finch starts off as a finch, and within 100 million years, there'll be a Galapagos elephant. Could be. But we need a whole lot more by way of evidence than a couple of nutty journalists going down there looking at finch beaks and writing a Pulitzer Prize-winning book. A whole lot more of this is to be serious science. I mean, this doesn't even pass the threshold of anecdote. Finch beaks change in size. Yeah, they do. They change in shape, too. It seems to be correlated with seasons. There seems to be a regress back toward the mean when the seasons change again. If this is the part of a spectacular evolutionary extrapolation, let's have additional reasons for thinking that.
The changes are temporary. They oscillate back and forth, and they don't go anywhere. So as evidence for the origin of species, Darwin's finches really don't work.
Critics of Darwin's theory say that finch beaks provide a good example of microevolution, small changes within a species or gene pool. But it does not by itself provide evidence for macroevolution, which is the origin of fundamentally new organisms and body plans.
When we look at dogs, no matter how far back we go, it's dogs. When we look at bacteria, no matter what we do, they stay bugs. They don't change in their fundamental nature. There seems to be some sort of an inherent species limitation, and we have no good explanation for this in terms of a Darwinian theory. We should have far more flexibility, far more plasticity under laboratory conditions than we actually do if Darwinian theory or anything like that were correct.
According to critics of Darwin's theory, the problems facing macroevolution can be clearly seen in yet a third icon of evolution, the four-winged fruit fly.
In opening a biology text, one will often see a picture of a four-winged fruit fly. Now, as we know, ordinary fruit flies have only two wings. The four-winged fruit fly has not only its regular set of wings, but a second set of wings just next to that. And the caption or the text will say, this is evidence for the process of evolution, that mutations affect the process of development, and you can get anomalies as interesting as a four-winged fruit fly. Well, it turns out that the four-winged fruit fly is actually a very poor example of Darwinian evolution, certainly.
There are no muscles attached to it, so the second set of wings is effectively dead. The fly is a hopeless cripple. It's kind of like having a small plane with an extra pair of wings tied to its tail. The fly can only survive in the laboratory, and it would be selected out by natural selection in the wild. So it's not a step forward in evolution. It's an evolutionary dead end.
Modern Darwinian theory, known as Neo-Darwinism, is based on the idea that randomly occurring mutations in genes provide the raw material needed for evolution to work.
The idea that mutations are considered the engines of evolution has only one problem. There's no evidence to support it.
So if you think about changes in the genetic code, can you think of any changes that would be beneficial or helpful to organisms?
Almost all mutations are deleterious. Almost all of them do the organism absolutely no good. In fact, we have a devilishly hard time finding any mutations that do the organism any good whatsoever.
These organisms only really survive in the laboratory. No other fruit fly will mate with them. These are not promising avenues for macroevolution. They're in fact dead ends for evolution because these mutations cannot be passed on by ordinary reproduction. It's almost as if the fruit fly says, if you want me to exist at all, I better have two eyes, six legs, two wings, and so on. I better have more or less the normal form.
Modern Darwinists contend that there are some cases where mutations do promote evolution. Their chief example could be considered another icon of evolution, antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Antibiotic resistance, in terms of natural selection, is an excellent example. And it's used. I mean, it's one of the hallmark examples given in microevolution for support of Darwinian thought. However, I think in the last few years, it's got to be reinterpreted to a degree.
Laboratory research shows that when an antibiotic is applied to literally